Good Monday morning. Hope your day's off to a pretty good start so far. Coming up to 10:06. Hi, and here we are into the second hour of the show this morning. I'm Rakow with you until 12:30 this afternoon, and here's what's ahead on the show for you today. It is time this hour for Science Files, and joining me this morning, St. Mary's University astrophysicist Rob Thacker, and I'll make the introduction in just a moment. After the news at 11, it's your turn to sound off this morning. Manic Monday's coming up for you next hour. It's our first open hour of the week, and of course, as always, anything goes. After the news at noon, we'll hear some budget advice for the McNeil government as it prepares its spring budget. Paige McPherson with the Canadian Taxpayers Federation will join me, and we'll hear another Halifax History Moment this afternoon from historian and author Blair Bead. But this hour, it is time for Science Files. And joining me in the studio this morning, St. Mary's University astrophysicist, Dr. Rob Thacker. Dr. Rob, good morning to you.
Good morning, good morning. And you've got Avi Loeb on your desk right there.
There
the
is.
Harvard professor talking about alien ships. Here we go.
And okay, my first question before you, when you came in, is Avi Loeb, is he a wacko case? And you said, no, he's legit.
No. Yep. Avi Loeb is a very excellent scientist. He is completely legitimate. He has a very long track record of doing very excellent research in cosmology. I mean, he's a professor at Harvard for a darn good reason. He is a darn good scientist. But he is an iconoclast. He's one of these people who says that, you know, 90% of my time I do really sensible, important science, and the other 10%, I'm going to do the crazy ideas because it's fun. And he does that. And he gets a lot of press attention for doing that. And he has this history. I mean, can you remember we talked about the fast radio bursts?
Yep.
And how that could possibly be leakage around a ship that was being pushed by alien signals?
Yes.
He was one of the authors of that paper as well.
Well, in his most recent comments, this rock that most are calling it an asteroid that was ejected from
another star system.
Billions of years ago.
Yeah.
It is pronounced Oumuamua, which is Hawaiian for scout. But he's suggesting that it's not just a rock, that it's some kind of alien spaceship checking us out kind of thing.
All right. Let's be completely fair to what he's saying. He's saying, well, you know, the thing that people don't understand is it went around the sun and it was going away, and it seemed to be going away faster.
Yeah.
Now, that could have been explained if it was like a comet and there were jets coming off it. That happens quite a lot.
But there was no tail, right?
There was no tail. There were no obvious jets coming off it. And so when people started to do the numbers, they were like, you know, it could just be the push from the sun. Literally, the light from the sun, what we call the radiation pressure, pushes things away from the sun faster than you would normally expect. And so people did the calculations for that and just about kind of can explain it, maybe, maybe not. And so he said, well, you know, this could be a solar sail, a ship with a solar sail that is capturing that light. There are issues with the particular geometry of the object. It is a bit strange. It's very long and thin. At least that's what the observations suggest. We don't have a good single picture of it. We only have information from what we call the spectra of it. And the spectra is literally how the light was changing over time. Well, it's actually the sort of like amount of light we have at different wavelengths, but that doesn't matter. What it suggested was it was spinning end over end, but he's suggesting it could be other things. And, you know, he's saying, look, if you've got a better explanation, I'll back down. And so there probably is a better explanation. It's just we don't know what it is.
He's being criticized by his peers. There's some grumbling, people suggesting, wondering about his sanity, and he's not backing down at all.
This is very measured. He knows what he's doing. He's a smart cookie. When there's a better idea that comes along, he'll definitely back down.
That's what he says. He says, if someone shows me evidence to the contrary, I will immediately back down.
Yeah, so it's clever, and I understand. He has 5 movie teams interested in making a movie about
is that
his
right?
life. So you can say what you want. I mean, he's a lot of value for money. Let's put it that way. He puts some good stories out, and he does some things that are worth thinking about. But the problem with it is, I mean, he ends up making things seem more realistic that this could be an alien thing than it probably is, right? And so if he took a little bit of a less polemic stance on it and said, well, you know, this explanation could be right, but it probably isn't, people would be fine with that. But he doesn't, right? He's standing up and going, show me I'm wrong, which is a bit aggressive for scientists and not something that people welcome. And so that's one of the reasons why this is getting so much play.
So, okay, this guy's legit astrophysicist from Harvard.
Yeah.
As opposed to just writing him off as the rantings from a madman. What do you say about this? What do you say?
So this is a situation where the amount of information we have just isn't enough to make or draw really strong conclusions. So we pointed a few telescopes at it. We listened to it with a radio telescope. There were no signals coming off it. If it was some kind of alien ship, you would probably expect some kind of leakage signals coming out of it or something like that. We didn't hear anything like that. And so I'm inherently skeptical. I would love it to be an alien ship. I admit it's weird. It's a little bit strange to have something come flying through the solar system, but we have new telescopes that are coming online in about 2022 that should find more of these things. And we may go from just finding the one that we know of right now to knowing tens, twenties, many of them. And once we start to know more about these things and how they come in and so on, then maybe we'll have better ideas for what they could be. I will admit the geometry is weird, but at the end of the day, we don't know for sure. It could be that one side is dark, one side is light or something like that. We don't know.
Where is this thing now? Do we know?
It's heading out of the solar system. I can't remember the exact trajectory.
Last I saw, a report said by Jupiter. And
yeah, quite possibly. It's going pretty fast.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a fascinating story, and I appreciate what Avi Loeb is saying here, and we'll see
someday. I don't know what to say. I mean, I have colleagues who really, really come down on him, and I think, funnily enough, in the end, that ends up creating a bigger press story, I guess.
Gives us something to talk about here.
Yeah, I sound so mild-mannered, I'm not going to come down on him, because he's got such a good track record of doing, great science. So,
And then, the fact that it's Avi Loeb has given some credibility to this whole thing. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got a comment or a question here for Dr. Rob this morning, you can also drop us a line via email, rick.howe@news957.com, or even tweet us a question or a comment at the Twitter handle at The Rick Howe Show. The headline in Science Daily, 1,000 new objects and phenomena in the night sky.
Ooh, yeah,
What's this all about,
this
Dr.
is
Rob?
So this is a new, well, it's not actually a new telescope, but it's a new experiment being done on a telescope. And so we tend to think of telescopes as being like giant magnifying glasses, but in actual fact, they're not really doing that. You can magnify things with them, but the thing you really want to use a telescope for is to capture as much light as you can. So when people say, what's a telescope? I think of it as a light bucket. It's capturing light. And so an old telescope down in California, which it was a specific design of telescope that images very, very large areas of the sky. Every image it takes is 240 times the size of the full moon, right? So it gets to see very, very faint things very, very quickly. And so that means you can do a scan of the whole sky. Now, why would you want to do that? Well,
see what you could see.
Well, to see what you can see on short time scales, that's the thing. Like, you can go back and re-image the same piece of sky every couple of days or something like that. You can capture things that are changing on the scales of a few hours. And people may say, how come we haven't been doing this? Primarily because when we use our big telescopes, we look at things for sometimes several hours. Right, so you don't get to see things change. So this new Zwicky transient facility, as it's called, is actually re-imaging parts of the sky to see how the sky is changing.
Well, I'm looking at a photo that's taken here of the Andromeda galaxy.
Yeah. So Andromeda, it can do pretty straightforwardly. Andromeda is about six times the width of the full moon, the particular image that they posted there. So that's an example of something that you can image actually fairly quickly with a wide field telescope, as it's called. But the main thing this is going to sort of open up is a whole new field of what's called transient astronomy. And so, like I said, we tend to sort of think of astronomy as things being evolving very slowly, it takes 250 million years for us to go around the center of the galaxy. And so we think, nothing's really happening. The constellations are changing too, but it's tens of thousands of years really to see any major changes. Whereas, there are variable stars, there are things that are explosions, stellar explosions, and so on. And this new particular Zwicky Transient Facility is going to find, I think, potentially millions of objects every night that are worth looking at.
New planets and all of that, right?
Well, so we'll find near-Earth asteroids is going to be the big thing, I think, for that. So something that's flying by and moving fairly quickly relative to the background, we'll be able to see those. But this is kind of like a stopgap until we have something called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which is coming online in 2022. And that's going to be much, much larger, see much, much deeper, much more quickly. And that will image the whole southern sky every 3 days. And that will get track about 840 million objects every 3 days.
Yeah. Wow. All kinds of telescopes going up there. The James Webb is up there. Is there a problem with that?
So there's still a delay in launching. So James Webb it's always called the follow-on to Hubble. It's not truly the follow-on to Hubble, but that's 2021 launched now.
All right. Coming up to 10:16, he is Dr. Rob Thacker, and he's with us here for Science Files this Monday morning. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. You can also send us a question via email. Our email address, rick.howe@news957.com. We'll be back to hear more from Dr. Rob right after this quick break. 10:19 here on a Monday morning, Science Files till 11, and Dr. Rob Thacker from St. Mary's University is my guest. Just before we read our first email question, again, looking at this photo of the Andromeda Galaxy.
Yeah.
What do we know about this galaxy?
Oh, we know a lot about M31. It's probably one of the most studied galaxies out there, if not the most studied one. It was discovered fairly early on by Charles Messier, so it's in his famous catalogue from hundreds of years ago, M31. And so it's a spiral galaxy, so sort of like a flattened disk galaxy, much like our own Milky Way, slightly different in terms of the geometry that we know about our Milky Way compared to M31, but hundreds of billions of stars all moving around, and it's moving towards us, so eventually we're going to collide.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. So about 5 billion years. So don't lose sleep.
Okay, good.
not a problem, not a problem. And so the question is, where will our sun end up? Well, interestingly, about the same timescale, the sun will be turning into a red giant star as well. But the short answer is we have no idea where the sun will end up. It could end up sort of like in the middle of the new galaxy that's formed, or it could end up sort of like pushed further away from it. We really don't know, right? And we obviously won't know in our own lifetimes either. So
this is a galaxy much like ours, so a sun and planets were, you know, revolving around
the
sun.
Yeah, so there'll be hundreds of billions of stars in this galaxy, all sort of like moving around. Some of them going around in the disk, some of them in what we call a halo type of geometry, moving around and so on. But seriously, this is a beautiful example of a nearby spiral galaxy.
Yeah. I can hear something. Can you in the background?
I can indeed hear something in the background.
Amber, you hear anything? We're hearing some noise, and it sounds like somebody's talking in the background there. Not sure what that would be. All right, well, let's continue on here. And Mark with a question from email. He says, I heard recently there was a meeting of flat earthers, or in layman's terms, nut jobs, he writes, gathering to solidify why the earth is flat and not round. He says, I'm guessing they think the earth and other planets are like giant bowls with a flat top and round bottom. Can you explain to those who believe such foolishness that the oceans of the earth would have simply drained over the edge and into space, and that the earth as we know it would not exist?
Yes. Next question. No, seriously. Yeah. I mean, remember, we have to talk about this briefly, but the Flat Earth Society was literally essentially started as a debate society where they know what the answer is and they were having to come up with arguments against it. So it literally was a bunch of fun. And of course, once you have something that people who are polemic get interested in, then they want to be contrarian and say all of these things. And so then people realize it gets them on the news. And so people start saying things that are wackadoodle.
Yeah.
And then because the news likes sensationalism, they get online rather than people going, oh, my word.
But back long ago, they did think the earth was flat.
A long time ago. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And that's a reasonable presumption because you can't see the curvature of the earth with your eye very easily. Once you get a telescope, you can, though, because you can see ships going over the horizon and things like that. But without something like a telescope, or even knowing that if you were at different places on the Earth at different times, the shadows would be in different places. That's how the Greeks kind of figured out there was a curvature. But it's not common sense. I accept that. But nonetheless, here we are in 2019. We can all agree that the Earth is a sphere, or a very close approximation.
Thank you very much. But I can only imagine back
thank you very much.
The early mariners, wondering if they were going to go off the edge.
For sure. I mean, it would have been a legitimate fear in that age, but they just kept going and going and going.
And then they found North America.
Yeah.
David Hensby, the city councilor, with a question here. He says, could you ask Rob about the impact of the magnetic North Pole moving? Mm-hmm. What influences on GPS and other navigating tools, even the basic compass? And he also wonders, will the magnetic fields eventually flip poles? Thank you, Councillor. What's your answer?
Well, so will it eventually flip? It's tough to say. We don't understand the state of the interior of the Earth. So the magnetic field is created by basically the movement of a certain layer in the core of the Earth, and that creates a magnetic field. And we know that it has flipped in the past.
So the South Pole becomes the North Pole,
the North Pole, the South Pole. Yeah. This has happened in the past. So that is always a possibility that it will happen again. With the sudden sort of recent movement we've seen, it's no one can tell you whether that's a prelude to it flipping. We really don't know. That's probably unlikely just because of how long it takes between flips. I think it's something like it's several tens of thousands of years between flips or something like that. So no one can really say. But it's pretty unlikely, so I wouldn't lose sleep too much over it. In terms of what it does for navigation, well, if your GPS, don't worry about your GPS. GPS is just fine. That's all a network of satellites, which it's not using any kind of magnetic field or anything like that.
But the compass would be an issue.
But a compass, particularly if you were up in the North Pole, would be a big issue. So if you're up in the North Pole and you're using a compass, then you'll have to know exactly where the magnetic North Pole is. I mean, to be honest, it's funny, the North Pole is not a great place for navigating because compasses don't work particularly well there, because there's a big separation between the spin pole versus magnetic pole. And then again, I'm not sure that the GPS coverage up there is so great either. But anyway, so yes, you would have to know about that. And I believe that ships that have been using compasses up around there are already having to compensate for the movement of the pole. So yeah, that's an issue. But like I said, with GPS, you're still good to go. No problems there.
And we have no idea, as you said, when the poles will flip. I mean, how do we know?
So people who work on the geodynamo theory may have some kind of ideas. But I mean, like I said, it takes quite, although the flip itself does happen very fairly quickly, apparently. But nonetheless, there's a long period between those flips.
And that doesn't have any impact on the planet at all, at least as far as human beings or life on the planet at all?
It's tough to say. I mean, so if the magnetic field did switch off, then we would have a bit of an issue with radiation coming down to the surface, getting into the atmosphere and so on. But the likelihood is that that flip happens sufficiently quickly that obviously it hasn't wiped out life on the planet before. So we shouldn't worry too much about it. Mm. And we can all, I mean, the thing with the atmosphere is still fairly thin, but it's very thick, comparatively speaking, in terms of how tall it is. So it does manage to stop a lot of radiation. And then all of the magnetic fields sort of push that radiation in a certain direction. We would be fine. Humanity would be able to take steps. I know some people worry that it would be a disaster, but I think we would be okay. The bigger problem as if the magnetic field went away completely, but that's very, very unlikely to happen, and I'm not even sort of like worried about that at all. So
yeah, and we wouldn't have been around when the last flip happened.
Our ancestors would have been around.
Is there any detailed record of that at all? Would they have known what was going on?
It's all figured
on?
Out from the geological record, as far as I'm aware.
All right, 10:26 is the time. Dr. Rob Thacker with me here on a Monday morning. This is Science Files, and if you've got a comment or a question, we'd love to hear from you this morning. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Still talking about space. NASA's New Horizons has thrown us some new pictures here, including what you describe as a pancaked peanut.
Well, I'm not describing
this
it.
This is that double rock.
The snowman. The snowman. So they sent back an image that's literally taken as it's going past. And they're really surprised because it seems to suggest that it's not sort of like two spheres plonked together like a snowman like we thought.
But they're two separate, are they?
But well, in fact, they're kind of like flattened. And so we just happened to catch the angle where we saw two more rounded things. And if it had just spun round a bit more, it would have looked like it was pancaked.
Okay.
They are saying they can't be 100% sure on this because it's a pretty grotty image, I will say.
Yeah,
that.
It is green,
they
yeah.
have all of these amazing images, and then this one isn't so great. So I'm not sure about this, and they're openly admitting they would like to get more data to look at this more carefully. The reason being, it's a real surprise if we just happen to take a picture and we happen to have everything aligned so that we see the rounded sides facing us. Normally, you kind of expect it to be an angle. Probability suggests that. So I'm not 100% convinced, but I guess we'll wait and see. There's something like 20 gigabits of data been taken, and we've only got a fraction of that down, as far as I'm aware. So there's still probably a lot more coming.
All right. We'll hear more about the New Horizons coming up after the break. But right now it is coming up to 10:28. We're going to take a break for a news update here in a moment. If you've got a question for Dr. Rob, again, the number's 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back with more Science Files with Dr. Rob Thacker after the news, and the news is coming up next. Ten 10:33 here on a Monday morning, Science Files. In the studio right now with us is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. And if you've got a comment or a question for Dr. Rob this morning, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Just reading here, British billionaire Richard Branson plans to travel to space within the next 4 or 5 months, hoping to do it this summer, in fact, on his Virgin Galactic spaceship. But I saw something on the TV news the other night. They made a successful journey into the first part of space.
Yeah.
Came back down and...
So they're not going to be doing orbital flights with Virgin Galactic.
Yeah.
They sort of get up to it. They get a little bit of, I think it's literally 30 seconds or a minute.
Something like that,
of weightlessness, and then they come back down. So this is what we call suborbital space flight. And so you would still get, I believe, astronauts' wings for getting above, the Kármán line or von Kármán line. But... it's not the same as getting up and into orbit at all.
So Virgin Galactic, that's Branson's. Now, there are a couple of others involved in this too. Will they still be suborbital? Or will they actually get a little...
Blue Origin is definitely going to be suborbital as well. That's on the new Shepard. Yeah, the new Shepard. There's the new Glenn, which is another rocket they're designing.
Okay.
But so they'll be suborbital too. They'll take people up in a little... it's not like Virgin Galactic is kind of like futuristic.
Yeah.
It's sort of like what the 1960s space flight you would have imagined it would be like. But Blue Origin have this stubby launch vehicle with a capsule that the crew will sit in, and then you'll come back down in that capsule as well. So
you'll actually blast off
as opposed to
Virgin.
So Virgin is a bit different.
They launch it from an aircraft.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you're literally sitting in the old Bombay doors, as it were, kind of thing, and then being launched from up at 40,000 feet or something like that. So it's a reasonable way to do it. And I don't know, though, because there's been some issues with this Spaceship 2 and so on. So there was the crash that killed the pilot about 3 years ago. So...
Branson says he's going to get in, and away he goes.
I don't know. I think it's going to be really interesting to see whether they get approval for passenger flights, because the safety requirements for airlines are really, really significant, and the reliability ratings that they're going to have to get to are going to be significantly higher than most rockets. I mean, if you want to know the average reliability of a rocket, it's about 99 times out of 100. That's not far off.
Mm.
So compare that to airliners, which are way, way, way better than that, right? Mm. So anyway, but I guess he wants to go up for the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, right?
July 20th, 1969, Apollo 11 landed on the moon. So July 19th, you get a phone call. It's Richard Branson. Hey, Rob, come on with me. I'm blasting off tomorrow. Would you go with him?
No.
No?
No, not on Virgin Galactic. Sorry, you've got to show me a better... And it's not the kind of flight I would like to do either. I've actually told people, the thing that I would like to do is, there was a company that was talking about taking very high altitude balloons up.
And you go up in one of those?
I'd go up in one of those.
Really?
Yeah, that would be really cool. It's kind of, they have their own safety risks, but they're probably more reliable than these particular spacecraft, at least at the moment, I would argue. So, and the other thing is you get to go up slowly. It's not an adrenaline ride. It's kind of like, as you can guess, I'm kind of like a contemplative kind of guy. I like adrenaline junkie stuff every now and again, but most of the time I like to think about what I'm doing and really appreciate it. So going up to the edge of space in a balloon, I would find really, really cool. Right. And that would be fun. I mean, though you could be like Felix Baumgartner, go up in a balloon and jump out at the top. I'm not going to do that. No way. But anyway, going up in a balloon would be a very different kind of experience. And you'd still be able to appreciate everything, too, as well.
All right. Daryl just sent us a joke via email. He says an astronomy major had a part time job working in the university's off campus housing office. One day, a fellow student, upon entering the office, thought about the morning lecture and asked, "What is an astronomical unit?" To which the astronomy major replied, "One hell of a big apartment."
Groan.
George with a question on December 21st.
That was a long setup for that punchline, wasn't it?
Yeah. George writes, on December 21st, we had 8 hours, 48 minutes of daylight. On January 14th, there were 9 hours, 10 minutes of daylight, 22 minutes longer, but the sunrise time was the same at 7:51 a.m. How is this possible?
I should remember this. So it's related to the particular position in the orbit and the rotation of the Earth. Sorry, it's escaping me right now. There is a very legitimate argument that the actual sunrise time does change a little bit. I can't remember the precise argument, but there is one.
All right, so there is... It's
completely legitimate. Someone in the local chapter of the Royal Astronomical Society was posting about this. So there is an explanation for it, yeah.
Okay. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got a question for Dr. Rob this morning, we'd love to hear from you. Looking at a story here that's headlined, Bias Against Funding.
It might even be the related to actually the axial tilt of the Earth as well. That could be part of it.
Okay. Story in the headline, Bias Against Funding Canada's Female Scientists Revealed Study.
Yeah.
That women are less likely to win grants when focus of the application is who leads the research.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on this, Dr. Rob? Your person.
Yeah, so this
you're involved in deciding, are you not, who gets research money at times and such?
Yeah. I am quite often. So this is very disconcerting. This is in medicine, right?
Yeah.
So in astronomy, we've been looking at this now for a number of years. And so a study a few years ago really sort of brought it to light that success rates for women were nowhere near as high as their male counterparts in many situations. And that was disconcerting because the logical assumption is men and women pretty much are the same. I mean, different people will have different views on that. We don't know enough about the overall structure of the brain to conclude otherwise. So we actually started looking into this. And so one of the first things that we did was to say, okay, let's make the review process what we call double blind, where you don't know who the lead person proposing the particular observations you want to do is, as well as you don't know who the referee is. Normally, you don't know who the referees are anyway, just so if people have sort of like really tough things to say, there's no personal vendettas afterwards.
Well, that sounds to me like that's the way to do it.
I tend to agree. So the argument was always that if you did things in a double blind way, you would still know who the person proposing the research was. But if the person writing the proposal knows it's going to be double blind, they won't self-cite themselves as when you actually cite your own research and then people can figure out who's writing the proposal. And so, lo and behold, once you changed everything to be double blind, women did miles better in some cases, as well, if not better, than their male counterparts.
Wow.
And so that made everyone sit up and take notice that, you know, there's still some biases, whether it's individuals or whether it's a bias in the system. It's a concern. I mean, there is actual studies of looking at how other women treat other women's proposals and suggestions that even they could be biased. So that's why we kind of think it's a systematic bias in the system. So the double blind does seem to work. It's a little bit challenging in some cases, but it does seem to work. So we're really sort of like looking at this carefully in astronomy. And the other thing I would say is Saturday Science Files that we had a couple of years ago, right? So we did an experiment. So initially it was Richard and I doing it and so on. And we got sort of a pretty good audience, but it was primarily men. And so when I was hosting, I made a point of always trying to have a woman on. 50-50 as soon as we did that.
Yeah, really?
Surprise, surprise. Yeah. So this representation really damn matters. So this is important for us to be aware of and to be making an effort to try and address these biases that are in the system quite obviously. And so hopefully we'll take a few years to absolutely get this right and get this sorted out, because obviously you want women coming into the field to have as good a shot as anyone else. Now, of course, women do have different career paths in terms of the fact that they may be taking time out, but again, to have children or things like that. But again, they come back and work, and they're just as capable of carrying on their career from when they took a step out to have a family. So this is something that we're working towards in our field, trying to be more understanding, more, I don't want to use the word accommodating, that's wrong, but more egalitarian about how we look at the system and so on. And so there definitely are ways around this, and there's definitely evidence that there are biases against women.
Well, this is important because, again, the push is on to encourage more girls at the school level to get involved in sciences.
Well,
and such,
so here's the thing. Right, that where you go and you look at performance of boys and girls in high school, girls generally tend to do better than boys, right? And so you got to wonder, why are we going from a situation where girls are doing better than boys in high school, and then suddenly you get all the way up to this research level and there's a bias against them? So this is really something to look very carefully at. And we're doing that right now.
Excellent. Dave and Steve, there, you're coming up next. It is at 10:43 here on a Monday morning. This is Dr. Rob Thacker with me this morning. This is Science Files. And again, the numbers, if you've got a question, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back to hear more from Dr. Rob right after this quick break. 10:46 here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob is with me, and David's on the phone with us here this morning. Hi, David.
Hi, Rick. Good morning, Rick. Dr. Thacker.
Hi.
Many years ago, when I was in school, I learned that the periodic table listed the elements from lightest to heaviest, depending on the electrons revolving around the nucleus.
It depends upon what you mean by lightest, but go ahead.
I learned the lightest was helium with one electron.
Well, so that's hydrogen.
Hydrogen. Okay. Yeah. I told you it's been a long time.
It's okay. That's why I'm here.
So why does Dr. Sheldon Cooper of the Big Bang Theory say technetium?
Right. So the reality is that what we do when we plot it up is we plot it up in terms of the number of protons and electrons. So we go from 1 to 118, whatever it is. And the fact of the matter is, just because the nucleus has more protons and neutrons in many cases. So the nucleus of atoms includes protons and neutrons. Neutrons are neutrally electrically charged. Protons are positively electrically charged. And then they're surrounded by the negatively charged electrons. And so just increasing the number of protons and neutrons doesn't necessarily translate into something being heavier. There is kind of a probability of that. But when you get down to the really detailed sort of like physics of how the metal is created in its particular crystal structure, then that actually depends upon electron structure and things like that. So in the end, you won't necessarily have the heaviest elements or the highest number of protons producing the heaviest elements. But there will be kind of a general bias in that direction. But the very specific density will actually relate to the very precise atomic structure and crystal structure of the metal.
I follow you. Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
All right. Have a great day.
All right, David.
Yeah, it's not a bad way of thinking, but it's not perfectly accurate because there are real details that come into it.
Thanks, David.
Back over 50 years.
All right, bud.
Keep on learning.
Indeed. 10:48. Here's an interesting story. Any kind of leak in space could spell trouble for the men and women who take it to the final frontier, including a leaking space toilet. What confronted the crew that's up there now, including Canadian David Saint-Jacques. They had to contend with a leak that spilled almost 10 liters of water into the space station's contained environment. And that's
that's seriously problematic because we tend to forget that if you have an overflow in your loo, which is horrible when it happens, but it happens every now and again, that's all contained by gravity.
Yeah.
Right? It's making everything go down onto
the
floor.
So up in space,
you know, it's not going on the floor. It's literally going everywhere. It could go in your face.
Yep.
right? So it's absolutely grim. So Chris Hadfield showed during one of his little on-camera sessions the cleanup kits that they have. So they have masks to put on, and they have vacuums that they would go around to use to suck these things up. It is a huge, huge problem when you have a leak like this in space, because it's not contained. It gets into the air system, and it's really not pretty at all, and it's potentially contaminating surfaces across the International Space Station. So this is a deeply, deeply concerning thing to worry about. And so this is one of the reasons why going to the loo in space is something that you have to be really, really careful about. Like, seriously, if you get any kind of tummy upset up there, that's not a good thing to deal with.
Yeah.
Right. So, I can't imagine.
Yeesh.
Seriously. It's actually a bigger problem than people really give credit for. So if you have, like, there was an issue in one of the Apollo missions. I can't remember exactly which one it was, but someone was sick. Then the vomit went around, and then someone had a problem with their other side, and then that got into the capsule as well. It's not pretty at all. Right? Seriously. So you have to have cleanup protocols and everything. So
it says here that the leak happened after astronauts accidentally detached a connection point to the water system while upgrading a restroom in the U.S. portion of the station.
Yep.
That does. I'm not familiar with the International Space Station, but there's a U.S. portion. There's other countries have portions.
I think the others, I'm not entirely sure, actually.
Russia, perhaps?
Presumably the Russians would have, so that would be part of it.
That'd be just like a little piece of home, basically, up in the space station? Or?
As much as the International Space Station can be a piece of home.
Because there's not a whole lot of room up there.
No, there's not a whole lot of room up there, and it's noisy. It doesn't smell particularly nice. So, it's not a hotel, that's for sure.
Here's another story headline. Scientists develop first fabric to automatically cool or insulate depending on conditions.
Oh, I love this
one.
This is great.
What is this now?
It's a new fabric.
So, it's from synthetic yarn with a carbon nanotube coating that is activated by temperature and humidity.
Yeah. So let me slightly take us on a little diversion.
Please.
First. So everyone always jokes about thermos loss, right? Keeps cold things cold.
Yes.
Keeps hot things hot. How does it know?
Yes.
Right? So that's just literally that if you insulate something, it will stay hot, whether you've got something warm outside trying to make it warm up, or whether you have something hot and you're trying to keep it warm. So that's just about insulation. In this particular case, they've designed a fabric that does two particular things. First thing is, the pores in the fabric will actually open up as it gets warmer, right? So to let heat out.
And
right?
They were closed.
Let air sort of move out. So that's not something that's new. We actually have designed textiles that do that before. Hmm. But what they've added on top of that is really cool. So infrared radiation is kind of like the heat radiation that we feel.
Yep.
And so if, for example, with the greenhouse effect, it's trapped infrared radiation that makes the temperature go up. And so if you have something trapping that infrared radiation, then you will tend to stay warmer. So they've designed a fabric that as the actual temperature of the fabric goes up, it lets the infrared radiation escape. So you can cool down as you get hotter. So that's really neat. Combined with the changing pore size, you now have this fabric that's really well designed for you. If you suddenly get warm, it will help cool you down. So I think this is really awesome.
And I mean, are we to the point where this fabric is now used in clothing, or this is still at the
experimental stage? This is still in the lab. So this will have been, I'm sure it's being talked about because they've just published a paper on it. But they do seem to have a working prototype of it. So how long before it gets into clothes? I don't know. The big question will always be, how much effort does it take to make the material? And secondly, is the material environmentally benign? Because carbon nanotubes aren't always the best things to put into the environment. In fact, my wife has been looking at this. Some of them can stay around for a long time and not easily dealt with by either bacteria breaking them down or anything like that. So they will probably have to look at how sort of biodegradable, for want of a better term, this particular fabric is. But nonetheless, it's a really, really cool idea. I really like it.
Yeah, especially in climes where, again, you've got, like ours, for example.
Yeah, no, I mean, how many times have you been like sort of walking around in the summer and you're like, oh, so warm, and you just take your, well, I mean, you can always take something off if it's too hot. I mean, until you get to nothing else to take off. But anyway.
Well, there you go. Yeah. 10:54 is the time. Every black hole contains a new universe. This is a physicist's solution to what he calls a present-day cosmic mystery. And that mystery is, of course, the black holes.
And this is not Avi Loeb, right?
No, this is not Avi Loeb. It says our universe, in fact, may exist inside a black hole.
Yeah, so this is... So I know a little bit about this. So when I started my graduate career, I was actually working in the field of general relativity. Hmm. And one of the things that we were doing back then, oh gosh, it's a long time ago, 1990s. So was looking at the overall structure or the global structure of space-times, as we call them. And the space-times of black holes had very unusual properties that allowed you, once you went through the event horizon, potentially to go into an entirely new universe. And so that was known quite some time ago. How real is that is very questionable, because the problem is the theory is only an approximation. The black holes exist within a bigger space-time, and whether or not these things would happen that people say could possibly be happened behind the event horizon, that kind of point of no return that you can't get out from, is it's questionable. But nonetheless, you can do the math. You can do what's called analytic extensions and work out what the structure of the space-time would be beyond the event horizon. And yes, potentially there could be other other universes. But it's a little bit, it's not what I would consider really easily testable, because you can't send someone in and get the information out, unfortunately. Yeah. So, black holes are ridiculous distances away as well.
Yeah.
So.
Kel with an email question. We're talking, going back to... the leak in the space station. He's wondering, does water evaporate on the space station?
So I suppose there's no reason why water couldn't evaporate. The main reason that things look weird is the surface tension ends up making all of the liquids float in bubbles. But obviously, you still have surface tension on the Earth, and things can still evaporate then. So yes, I'm pretty darn sure things can still evaporate in zero gravity as well. Mm.
But that bathroom situation up there, I can't imagine how they can go to the bathroom, let alone dealing with the a leak afterwards.
There is a vacuum system that's used, basically.
It's a vacuum system, is it?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're taking a pee, it's not too bad. That's straightforward, and you can deal with that. But the other...
Number twos
is a little bit more difficult to deal with, but nonetheless, there is a way of making sure you don't get too much leakage. Of course, this is reminding me of what was the Mars movie that Matt Damon was in?
The Martian.
The Martian, where he actually goes and uses all of the poop to put something for the nutrients for the potatoes
for
to grow.
Yeah. Worked in the movie.
Yeah, well, no shit.
Dr. Rob, appreciate, as always, your presence here on a Monday morning for Science Files and your knowledge about things of which I have no knowledge.
Always
of.
A lot of fun. Thanks, everyone, for the questions.
Dr.
As well.
Rob Thacker and Science Files here on a Monday, and he'll be back with us after or off next Monday. Next Monday's a holiday, so back on the 25th. Coming up now to 2 minutes before 11 o'clock, we're going to break for a news update in just a few moments. After the news, it's your turn to sound off this morning. It's time for Manic Monday. It's our first open hour of the week, and that means anything goes in the coming hour. And all you have to do is give us a call, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Got something to say this morning? I'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. We'll take your calls after the news. The news is coming up next.